Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Hi, I'm Josh.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three fans and the occasional guest who love the classic Doctor Who series and who are trying our best to love the new series too. We'll take you through five rounds rapid and get to the bottom of what's great and what's not so great about our favorite show. Round one, Temporal Grace, in which we do our best to say something great about contemporary Doctor Who in all its forms.
So right before recording this episode, I showed these boys what all our listeners have probably already seen on YouTube, the 50 years of American Doctor Who. Man, I love this
thing. The name
makes
us laugh.
When I encountered this, I watched it, I don't know how many times, just straight in a row. I thought it was perfect. So for those of the people who don't know it, it's as if Doctor Who had been made as an American television show, and the Doctors are Burgess Meredith, Dick Van Dyke, Vincent Price, Gene Wilder, Kyle MacLachlan, Christopher Walken, Tony Shalhoub,
Jeff Goldblum,
Nicolas Cage, Sam Rockwell, Donald Glover,
and Bryan Cranston.
And Harrison Ford.
Oh man, it is just amazingly well chosen.
All the choices are perfect, but none of them are the first ones, I think, off the top of your head necessarily. So it has that great surprise factor, but also it totally makes sense for each one. So it's just and it has that great comic structure of anticipation. Once you see what the structure is going to be. This actor as this doctor, just each time you're like, and what's next? And it doesn't disappoint.
It doesn't. They have funny little things, like there's that shot of Gene Wilder in the striped blazer on a river somewhere that looks like he could have been right out of Shada.
Yeah.
There is Jeff Goldblum running around in a cricket vest.
Yeah, that's from The Tall Guy, which is, I think.
Nice.
Which is like a favorite movie of mine.
The other great thing about this is it makes you laugh, and then there's those one or two things where that secret geek part of you goes, I'd kind of like to see that.
I would actually like to see
that. It's Kyle MacLachlan that makes me go, I'd kind of like to see that.
With his psychic paper that says he's from the FBI.
Oh, that's hilarious. A lot of the Kyle MacLachlan scenes are taken from The Hidden, I think.
Yes. Yeah, that's why he's touching his face because he doesn't recognize who he is right now.
Yeah, which is one of those movies that I am surprised isn't better known.
That's a terrific movie. I've seen it.
Yeah.
The clip from, it must be Cowboys and Aliens, right?
It's from Cowboys and Aliens.
I never saw it, but it manages to imbue that little thing with a lot of pathos, which, frankly, we were just talking about Day of the Doctor in the last episode, is kind of absent from John Hurt's script there. You don't see him really mourning over anybody in particular.
No, he's pretty cuddly for someone called the War Doctor.
Yeah.
you want to hug him. Not Harrison Ford. I would not hug him.
No.
I think Harrison Ford would slug me if I tried to hug him.
Yeah, I'm afraid I'd break his hip.
So that's what we love about Doctor Who this week.
And now, round two, Special Topics Dalek. Today's topic is, name your favorite regeneration scene.
I guess I would have to say my least favorite regeneration scene.
Let's keep it negative, too. Let's see. best and worst.
Least favorite is clearly 6th to 7th.
Which doesn't exist. Or, well, exists in a fake way.
Yeah.
It still counts. It's canonically fake.
I acknowledge that. I would still say that my personal least favorite is the one where David Tennant doesn't actually regenerate, but regenerates into, oh, no, the first time.
Okay.
Where he regenerates into like a fake version of himself, a human version.
His regeneration energy gets sucked into the hand.
Oh, right. He takes the hand. The hand grows into a fake David Tennant.
Yes.
Which then goes into a parallel universe.
With Rose.
With Rose.
Yes.
Okay. That's the one I'm thinking of.
Yep.
That's my least favorite regeneration scene. If you were in love with someone okay. and they regenerated into an arm-created version of themselves.
Yes.
Like, would that mean... Like, what would you feel about that? Depends. Would you feel like you had the right person?
Depends what I loved about them. If it were their hands.
But they're identical.
Like a hand model you fell
They're
in
identical
with,
in every way. They have the same memories. They have the same body. But you know that there's another person that was a primary person that they spun out of. I felt the same way in that the whole alternate universe thing where, remember Rose's mom goes in the alternate universe with the father?
But, yeah, but that's not a happy the person. Ending, but it isn't the person. Yes, it does suggest some sort of strange... quasi-ethical, no one's really getting hurt.
No.
It's a victimless crime.
Yeah.
It's like prostitution, is what you're saying.
It's like
God.
It's like, you know, marrying your wife's twin sister or something like that.
Now it's getting appealing again.
Yeah.
Come on. A better comparison. No, I do see what you're saying. It is treated in the narrative like... It's the same person.
As a success.
It is. The question isn't even raised. And I think if there'd even been like an eyebrow raised or we share something somehow across the different versions or something, yeah, some throwaway line might help to make that better as opposed to like, yay.
Yeah, it implies something, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but something like kind of disturbing about what human existence means in the Doctor Who universe. If you can duplicate yourself so easily... And does it? Okay.
It does.
All right. We'll save this for a later podcast.
Yeah, but this is maybe another special topic.
Yeah.
But
so I regeneration scene.
Favorite regeneration scene. I would probably go probably fourth to fifth.
It's a great one. Terrific.
Fourth to fifth.
But again, that regeneration scene works because that whole episode, you have the Watcher wandering around and the uncharacteristically somber Fourth Doctor as he realizes like. Oh, this is way bigger than I thought.
What's your least favorite?
Sixth to seventh?
Sylvester McCoy in a wig lying on the floor of the
Yeah, doors. I mean, it's just like, you know, they don't even really bother to explain what the hell happened.
Buffeting.
Yeah. Thank you. Ronnie Buffeting.
Is it the novel Spiral Scratch supposedly gives some kind of explanation for...
It does. I have not read
what
it.
The heck happened?
You just out-nerded me, Kelvin.
Yep.
I've only read like a synopsis of it, but apparently it's involves some
Don't
sort of...
spoil it.
...thing that the Sixth Doctor did right at the end of his life that like left him unusually exhausted for the Ronnie's... assault on the TARDIS.
So exhausted enough that turbulence caused.
And then there was like, there's some other weird thing where some other writer postulated that he sort of subconsciously forced himself to regenerate.
Yeah, from the new adventures.
Because he needed to have a different form to do this like nastier, darker stuff. That was
I remember
up.
That from some of the books
yeah.
I
yep,
read.
The new
I don't
adventures
remember,
did that.
Was it one of the Time Worm books, maybe?
I can't remember
suggestion
which book,
of
but they
suicide.
Suggested, essentially. Yeah. Or murder. They've also suggested that the Seventh Doctor from inside forced this regeneration
murder
to come on
Colin
the scene.
Baker. Yeah.
Yes.
That's wonderful, man. That's the stuff that those novels did really well. They just suggested
wild,
all of this odd,
crazy ideas.
So that's your favorite. That's fourth to fifth is your
fourth
favorite.
Fourth to fifth and sixth to seventh is least favorite.
Nice.
My least favorite is definitely Tennant's other regeneration. I just think...
The final complete
it
one?
It just, to me, flies in the face of the character and even Tennant's character. I have to imagine, I don't know it, that he couldn't have liked that.
It's again that thing of like, we have to have it be as emotional as humanly possible.
But what it backfired, instead of being emotional, and he seemed very childish. He seemed to kind of rant and, you know, rage against his death and I don't want to go as a last line and just moping until he finally pops off. It was really weird and I see what they were going for. It just failed miserably for me.
There was a moment in that episode where he was trapped in the radiation chambers with the old man, with Donna's grandfather.
Yeah.
That I thought, oh, is this going to be it? Is he going to die with only just this old man as
his witness? Which could have been really touching.
Which would have been wonderful, yeah.
But again, Russell T. Davies doesn't do those small moments that would...
Yeah, not when it counts, anyway.
Yeah. It's not when it counts. You're right. He has a skill for it, but it seems like, yeah, when he gets into the sci-fi narrative, he wants to go big. And so he travels around, sees all his friends, and it just
sets up Captain Jack with some...
Yeah, some and that's, it's one of your last dude. Acts to set up a tryst in a space bar. It seems just not Doctor Who-y to me.
It's Dono winning lottery ticket as I
well. Well, if you buy the whole like very long regeneration process and trying to say goodbye to the people you knew in that lifetime, well, what would Captain Jack want?
He'd
want to get laid. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So he's sort of like Santa. He's sort of dying Santa who comes and sets everyone up.
Yeah.
I think what I would have liked is if he bumped into dying John Pertwee. Lost in the time streams from that of the spiders. And they had a little chat as they both slowly died. And then stumbled out of the wrong TARDIS, maybe. I don't know.
That yeah,
it got a little farcical in my mind, in my head canon. But my very
in your
favorite,
Doctor Who fan fiction, you can write that.
My very favorite is 5th into 6th.
That's really cool.
Aside, I like the drama of the death scene. Yeah. I like because... Peter
it's a
Davison.
Different kind of extended, long process.
And he's vulnerable. He's such a vulnerable portrayal of the Doctor.
Yeah.
So those moments, it's the first time, I think, where they show, again, what I think they were trying to do with Tennant, but they do way more successfully because it's smaller with Peter Davison, is that he's actually afraid. And it has this just really uncomfortable, I think, in a good way. Not too long or not too visceral for kids or anything. And then as iffy as Twin Dilemma ends up being, that first, literally, when Colin Baker explodes into the scene and he is actually, unlike all the other doctors, he's not baffled or confused. He seems immediately
he's
alert.
He's just insane. Right.
But he's not even insane. He's just immediately alert. He's not confused or jumbled and is just, he seems...
Focused.
And I just think that whole, and even the soundtrack and the special effects, it all comes together and makes this geek very happy.
Oh, like the smile that, on that, your
that's
face.
Probably a close second.
Well, you guys have taken my top two, actually. So let me do a little shout out for John Pertwee's regeneration scene, which is also quite nice.
I got a good one.
That's something that happens mostly in Solitude, because he's, as you mentioned earlier, he's traveling back from being poisoned by the queen spider, and who knows how long he's in the TARDIS in the vortex,
suffering, and lisping.
and falling out of the TARDIS, the feet of the Brigadier and Sarah, and has a nice little moment.
It's cool that he regenerates in front of the Brigadier and Sarah. Yeah.
There you go, regeneration, good, bad, and the ugly.
Okay, now it's time for round three, the randomizer. Normally, each week, we randomly choose one adventure from the classic series and discuss it. However, for our first three episodes, we're going to discuss the classic adventures that introduced each of us to Doctor Who. And now we will be discussing Josh's introduction to Doctor Who, which was the episode Vengeance on Varos.
Kind of late in the game, Josh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a late bloomer. So this was on PBS for us in the Twin Cities. They would play one run of Doctor Who stories on Friday night at 10, and then another Saturday night at 10. So they were running, when I first tuned in, they were running Colin Baker's first season on Friday night, and they were running Tom Baker's first season on Saturday nights. And so I tuned in Friday night at 10 o'clock and saw Vengeance on Varos, and I was kind of a science fiction nerd, and I just got immediately caught up in the story. At 12 years old, I loved Syl. I thought he was hilarious.
He was your hero.
Yes, I got confused. I thought it was all about Syl. I didn't know.
It's the Syl
and his
show.
Fight against the Doctor.
Starring Syl.
And other socialists. No. I recognized right away that the Doctor was the main character. And so I know a lot of people don't have Colin Baker as their first Doctor.
I know. I cannot imagine my first exposure to Doctor Who being the Sixth Doctor era. That would be just like
And I
really odd for me.
I really loved it. It just it sucked me in. I didn't even get at first the TARDIS. I thought it was like a little like shuttlecraft that brought them down from the spaceship they materialized. Right. And then I slowly realized this was before the internet. You know, I started looking at books at the bookstore and Doctor Who magazine. When I bought comic books, I saw it at Schindler's, and so I started reading and slowly figured out the whole regeneration thing. Well, I figured it out when I tuned in Saturday night to see Ark in Space, which we discussed last episode, and saw it was a totally different actor. And so slowly started to piece it together, and, you know, to me, that's what pulled me into Doctor Who, that is the regeneration idea. That just seemed captivating that you would have different characters as your lead. They are essentially the same character, but that you would have drastically different. But at the same time, to me, because of what they played, I know a lot of people talk about Colin Baker, and he's harsher and more violent, but my first three doctors in the series of a couple months of watching this, because they played it every week, was Colin Baker, and then first season Tom Baker, who is far sharper, shorter, has shorter patience, is really hard on Harry Sullivan, and then they immediately, as soon as they finished the first season of The Sixth Doctor, they rolled around and started playing the first Doctor from the beginning, who's also another harsh, sharp doctor. And to me, that was just sort of, he was kind of a quick wit, but a short temper. And
that's a real interesting introduction.
And then I started getting all these mamby-pamby pacifist doctors. And who are these people?
And it formed your personality ever since.
Yeah, and I guess my start was with the more, you know, pacifistic-y kind of doctors or something, which might be why I did not warm to the Sixth Doctor era as much as some other people I know. But yeah, Vengeance on Varos is probably my favorite Sixth Doctor episode.
Looking at it as a very dark comedy that is occasionally not funny, I think it works really well. It's definitely a little schizophrenic. It seems like, and I don't know all the behind the scenes stuff. I think I've read and heard that there were a lot of rewrites, and Eric Sayward did stuff to it. And the couple particularly seems more like him. They seem a little, they're definitely funnier and very kind of a Robert Holmes double act style. When they keep cutting back to the couple watching it on
the
TV,
the husband and wife,
and they are, I think, really funny, and the satire sharp.
It's a good satire of uneducated masses just sort of consuming entertainment without any critical sense.
It reflects a particular period in televised entertainment too, where you just kind of watch whatever's on, right? Mm-hmm. And if whatever is on is sadistic murders of presumed rebels, then you watch that and you argue with your spouse about whether last week's was better or this week's is better.
Yeah. And I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah, it is a dated way to watch television even.
And it's going on at the same time that the whole British video nasties
is
happening too.
Yeah.
Which, as Americans, I don't, you know, I was not intimately a part of, but know it by reputation. Yeah.
So it's commentary on that. It's one of the things I like about it, and again, it might be because there were too many cooks in the kitchen, but whether it was intentional or not, it ends up at least having the appearance of complexity in that there's a lot of commentary going on. There's commentary on capitalism, yet at the same time, there's commentary on
the democratic process.
The democratic process.
It is like a really weird, you know, the government system on Varos is really strange. It's like a weird combination of Athenian democracy and dictatorship.
Yeah.
At like the same time.
And it's being exploited by an outside concern, too. Sills is representative of some wider intergalactic consortium. I forget the details or whatever that. As soon as this ridiculous Galatron backwater becomes at all valuable, comes in and tries to extort the best possible deal out of it, which is...
historically, and you have the governor who's almost a figurehead. He's basically there to be executed
for entertainment. Yes,
for entertainment purposes. You know, like, well, here's my proposal. What do you think, public? And the public just says no, and he gets zapped with pain rays.
But that's what I mean by the complexity. Because on one hand, it's like, you know, capitalism exploiting the people, but yet it's also criticizing the people who just want you know,
not yeah,
just to be desensitized, mm-hmm, but you know, by violence and to watch dumb stuff on TV. So it's like, it's complicated. If it were heavy-handed one way or the other, I mean, certainly it's heavy-handed, but there are multiple hands.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
It's not a subtle satire.
The more
but
you think about
on.
It, the more you realize what you know. Like, you know, it's a really cynical point of view. But watching it, I didn't really particularly feel like it was a cynical story, really.
Well, do we think that the rebels are at all effective? Like, if the Doctor and Perry hadn't shown up, would they have ever accomplished anything?
No, they're very useless.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very wet.
Because the Doctor had to bring the information. The critical change comes when the Doctor, the outside person who contrasts with the outside person in Syl, who provides them the information that actually... the stuff you have here, what you mine is very valuable, and you're being ripped off, and that's the information that tips the scales. And without that, I don't think so. Plus, and again, I don't know if it's intentional or if it's more of that like different rewrites and having it be really schizophrenic. The dialogue is really bizarre in here sometimes because like the rebels, like James Bond Jr., Sean Connery's son, speaks in this very stilted high diction, like that. Is really funny. And again, I thought it was funny, so I don't know if it's intentional or not. I wrote down one area where they're asking them about the punishment dome, and he describes it as areas of ingenious danger lurk in every corner. You can die in so many varied and spectacular ways. And it's like the back of a novel, kind of the way he talks.
Yeah,
but everyone
like
else,
advertising copy.
Yeah, but no one else other than the rebel speaks that way. And again, I don't know if it's script
I didn't
editing
think that.
Or what, it stood out to me because you have the very naturalistic every man conversation with the couple watching throughout the entire thing.
And you have the quasi-Shakespearean governor.
The governor, yes.
A little
very,
like Richard II.
Yes, very dramatic. And Martin Jarvis is excellent in this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He really sells that. And it's a really fine line between melodrama and some sort of sense of real emotion. And I think he pulls it off.
That was the problem with judging the attitude of any particular Doctor Who story, right? It's like, what happens between the script, the rewrites, the actors from their different theatrical traditions, the director?
Well, I did read somewhere that this was intended... Like, at one point, this was intended to be a much more comic story, and then it either got rewritten or interpreted by the director in a much more straight kind of way.
The comedy's there on the page. I mean, all of Syl's dialogue is over the top. His performance, I think it's really funny. That's one of the things I loved as a kid, and it's just weird.
Yeah.
Like when he has to be sprayed down, man.
I hate that guy.
And he's just stuffing stuff in his face.
Yeah, it does. I think it works better than a lot of other scripts of this era. Even on in the visual design, you were mentioning before we broadcast this that it doesn't look as cheap as some of the other things.
No,
because the '80s is always accused of being overlit, and this one is really it's shadowy and atmospheric.
Yeah.
You look at some of the Sylvester McCoy ones with a really harsh video.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, that's so ugly.
But yeah, I don't know why they went with that super weird.
But this one
video.
Is the tone and everything visually is very consistent. I mean, there's the controversial acid bath scene.
Yes.
But watching it again, I mean, again, I'm coming from that thing where it's my introduction to Doctor Who, and to me, throughout the entire series, there's so many occasions where the Doctor is very callous in the face of death.
Yeah.
And so many other times, it's pretty much split in half, and it seems like it's just an aspect of his personality that comes to the forefront in different regenerations. But he's all the time from the... You know, the first Doctor, the fourth Doctor.
He just seems
sixth
extra,
doctor, very
super
callous.
Duper callous.
Well, he rarely makes, like, cynical commentary on the deaths until this period, right?
Well, now I'm lacking in an example, but Tom Baker, while he might not make jokes, he certainly is very nonchalant and shows no emotion, and he's certainly in episodes accused of not being
now,
emotional.
Now, that's true, and the big
things.
Example of that I remember is in Pyramids of Mars, where he pushes Michael Sheard's dead body out of the way, and Sarah calls him on it, and he's like, essentially, are you kidding? We need to move on with stuff. But here, Colin Baker actually says something cruel, I don't remember exactly what it is, to the guys who died in the acid bath after their death.
It's not cruel so much, it's a quip. I'm blanking on what
James
it is.
Bond-y
like,
sort
he's like,
quip,
you know, forgive
you'll
me.
Pardon me if I don't join you.
Pardon me if I don't join you once they've fallen into the bath.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they clearly, he does not push him in. I don't know where that started.
It's I always thought of it as a very deliberate, like, shove into acid.
It's, there's a close-up of the other burning guy, which is pretty grotesque.
Yeah.
He's full of blood and burns, and he grabs the other guy by the leg and just pulls. It's a close. No, it's literally a close-up of the guy pulling
it again,
him in.
It's clearly a self-defense thing.
Yeah.
But his reaction to it is really, was too much for me.
There's this idea that you would deal with death with a joke does not seem completely to me outside of what is established with the doctor's persona.
I think that's fair. I think it was probably not the right choice to make at this point in the series, having just introduced a sort of eccentric, unusual doctor, and in this episode, starting it off with the particularly cruel sequence where he thinks that the TARDIS is stranded.
Yes.
That Perry's just going to die and he's going to sit there
And like,
regenerate
like a sudden moping thing. It's like, what the hell is that about?
Full of self-pity and no compassion for...
Yep, I agree. And I think part of the problem being is that Perry always plays it. We were commenting on Ark in Space where with Harry Sullivan, the doctor says really mean things and it's just like he just smiles and it's like it never even happened. She always seems like a puppy that's being kicked. She always looks kind of hurt.
Yeah.
And vulnerable in her leotard.
Oh.
Her colorful leotard. I think that's the big difference. To me, I've watched this season together. It's almost one of their first story arcs. It's just not clear enough in each episode that this is still post-regenerative trauma.
Sure.
And by the last couple episodes, he even says that I'm feeling more myself. But just taken out of context, it just seems like he's
They were doing, like... You know, sort of, they were trying to do this, like, very long arc thing with the Sixth Doctor where his personality stabilizes over time and stuff. And I don't think people were prepared for
that. It was pre-arc television.
Yeah. And it all blew up anyway because they changed direction really heavily in the second Colin Baker season of...
Yep, and they mellowed him out
because
a
the
lot.
Ratings were going
bad. I personally like the harsher Sixth Doctor, but... No, the other thing I really like when I re-watch these episodes is when I originally saw them on Channel 2, they were edited together into a movie format, so I never got to see any of the cliffhangers.
Right.
So I'm mildly obsessed with the cliffhangers in the DVD because they're like the new thing to me when I re-watch these because I never saw them. And the cliffhanger at the end of part two, there's only two parts in this, but is one of my favorites. And it is pretty dark, where the doctor has looks as if he has died from I don't know, heat stroke in this
in the desert,
psychic desert that has killed him off. But Colin Baker acts his little striped pants off, and they actually let him collapse to the ground, and the close up on his face with his eyes wide open. There's sweat, his eyes are glazed and wide open, and there's this close shot, and they're doing the directing thing, and like a close up and cut, and then the theme music kicks in. It's awesome.
That's probably the best cliffhanger of the Sixth Doctor.
And then it is a nice parallel because the very last image of the show, again with talking about the complexity of some of the commentary. Usually all the rebels are excited. The doctor's freed them. They have all this freedom, and they have the joke with the couple there where it's like, we're free. What should we do? I don't know. And then they cut to the TV with static, and there's nothing on it, and cut away.
Yeah.
So it mirrors nicely, I think. I mean, it definitely has its warts to it. I would say the really horrible miscasting of the bony old Englishmen in diapers, the cannibals. Now, if they had done that in shadow, and or maybe just let them look a little like torn up, wearing old guard uniforms and menacing with clubs or something.
Yeah, the diaper outfit was a bad choice.
But and the fact that they look like you could just give them a quick kick to the groin and you'd
I think
be safe.
We can all agree that cannibals in diapers are the best way to go out of this round. Okay, time for round four. This is our wonderful afunctionalism. These are the bits and pieces that don't fit anywhere else. And this week, the question that arose right before this podcast was, what's your favorite or not so favorite non-politically correct moment of Doctor Who? There's a lot of them, boys. There's a lot of them.
Oh, God.
Here, I'll start. It came to mind when we were talking about the two doctors, and that whole thing is about race. It's about androgums and how they can never be, you know, normal, non-cannibalistic people again.
Yeah.
But it penetrates in this dark Robert Holmes way into the dialogue of all of the characters. The second Doctor even criticizes Jamie, I think in the very first episode, as, you know, stop talking in that mongrel dialect or whatever. He's referring to his Scottish, his Highlander dialect.
Why would the second Doctor talk to Jamie like that?
He never did in the original show, you know, but, you know, once Robert Holmes, who knows, I can't speak for the man, he's dead, but, so there are many...
Dead people can be as racist.
Many examples of this, but that's the one that always sticks out, is this weird, weird racist thing, and it's not just a single instance of it, but it sort of penetrates that entire adventure, and I love the two Doctors, but it's there.
Yeah. I would have to go with a similar thing. I have to go with the talents of Wang Chiang and the villain, who is a very stereotypical Chinese man played by a white guy.
Oh, yeah.
And again, I talents of Wang Chiang is honestly one of my favorite stories of Doctor Who of all time. But, yeah, you know, you got to acknowledge there's this big racist pile of crap right in the middle of it. I mean, you know,
it's hard to separate because Robert Holmes clearly so loved in the pulp roots of this kind of amazing fiction.
He wrote both of the episodes that
we're
talking about.
Those, so he is steeped in that pulp literature, and that pulp literature is very racist, or at least works on those type of stereotypes at its least.
Well, I wonder
that's Fu Manchu.
Well, I mean, I don't know if Robert Holmes was responsible for the casting.
Yeah, that's a totally different thing. I mean, he's obviously playing on Fu Manchu. He's still having him as a diabolical, and there aren't any, you know, other Chinese to sort of balance that out. They're all really disposable, and the Doctor doesn't really care about their deaths.
Yeah, I don't know if the BBC is like, well, we can't have any actual Chinese actors. Or maybe, I know there weren't any available. I mean, I don't know. But
I think there probably weren't any available because there weren't any available, right?
Yeah.
Because of years of not having roles.
I mean, you would think there'd be some from Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong was a British colony, you know?
Yeah.
You'd think they could have cast an actual giant rat instead of using a puppet.
Well, yeah, the stuffed animal giant rat
too.
It's so speciesist.
It is.
Well, what about you, Josh?
My favorite moment is kind of a meta-sexist moment in The Five Doctors, where Terrence Dix actually...
Meta-sexist moments are the best sexist moments.
where Terrence Dix comments on the sexism of earlier Doctor Who, in which he has the first Doctor tell Tegan to go get them some beverages, some refreshing beverages, because that's what they could all use right now in the Death Zone. And Tegan, of course, looks at the Fifth Doctor aghast, and he tries to calm Tegan by basically saying, it's okay. He gets a little cranky, I've mellowed, and then he adds on, and Turlough can help you. And Mark Strickson does this great bit where he very slowly and passive aggressively buttons one button on his jacket and says, thank you, and walks off. Because the Fifth Doctor's idea is to balance out the sexism with an emasculation of Turlough.
isn't Tegan a flight attendant?
Yes.
Isn't she used to getting
she
people drinks all the time?
She specializes in beverages, yes.
So what's
so get on it, woman! Jeez! That's clearly, like, you know, acknowledging an earlier era.
Yes, that's a sexist earlier era acknowledging an even more sexist even earlier era.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the, you know, slowly climbing that ladder towards equality.
Slowly.
A very embarrassingly long ladder. But, you know.
And that's our wonderful afunctionalism for this week.
Yay!
All right, so it's time for our fifth and final round of the episode, The Death Zone. So in this round, we're going to pair two different Doctor Who texts and see which one comes out on top. This week it is the Neil Gaiman written Matt Smith episode, Nightmare in Silver. Thank you, Kevin. and the Big Finish Mark Platt-written episode, The Silver Turk, starring Paul McGann. These are extremely different in a lot of ways, but they have a central image.
Bizarrely similar.
Bizarrely similar. They have a central image at the heart of them. Yeah. They both have a destroyed or partially destroyed Cyberman playing chess in the manner of the famous 18th to 19th century automaton, the Turk, which was presumed to be an automated device that would play chess against the crowned heads of Europe and whatever, which was, in fact, a guy hidden in there somewhere playing chess against oncomers. So where do we go with this, guys?
Hands down, the Silver Turk for me.
Hands down, the Silver Turk. Kelvin, are we declaring our allegiance right up the top?
I really liked the Silver Turk, but I think I got to go with Nightmare in Silver.
Make your case, son. Make it.
A lot of it because the Cybermen in Nightmare in Silver are honestly about as scary as I've ever seen the Cybermen.
Mm-hmm.
And the Silver Turk, it's like these two damaged Cybermen that are just sort of caught up in 1870s Vienna stuff.
Yeah, I totally see what you're coming from. But I mean, to me, I think the idea of the damaged Cybermen that are early Cybermen that still have vestiges of their humanity to them and that they still can kill people when they're damaged and they've managed to put extra limbs on their body and they're just going to keep coming. And obviously the damaged monsters are they're going for the Frankenstein vibe with Mary Shelley.
Yeah, I think that might,
Doctor's companion in this.
Might have been a thing with me was that the Frankenstein grab was just
a little
too on the nose.
And they play with that a lot in all Eighth Doctor media because they're spinning off of the 1996 TV movie where Frankenstein was playing in the background. But I think comparing the two, they're very different. Very different. And it's a lot of it is because of just the nature of what you do as a television drama as opposed to an audio drama. On TV, the escalation of interest happens through action, like you were talking about, a suspense. In the audio dramas, it's largely through the revelation of mystery.
Right.
What's going on? And so the plots tend to be multi-layered, sometimes to the point of over-complexity in both the books and the audio dramas.
A criticism of Doctor Who in general, I think.
Yeah,
but often the audios, when you look at it at the end, it's pretty simple. They've just had to really complicate it, because the Silver Turk is essentially two Cybermen crash.
Yep.
I mean, that's really, when you get down there, they crash.
But then you also have these additional layers of these people discover them, and they use them to build marionettes. Marionettenberg was my favorite from that whole thing. But that's parceled out. That information is parceled out in an interesting and subtle way over the course
of the like horses, the Silver Turk,
they sound like woods. It sound like wood. And, where was I going? But I just...
Well, I think the Silver Turk, one of the uses, you say the sound. The sound design on this is really good.
It's really creepy sound.
It's cliche, but this audio is so atmospheric from the sound. And some of it is the script. Some of it is the sound design. Mark Platt's really good at throwing out a couple bits of dialogue in that classic audio style. Like a boring version would be, look out, he's got a gun. But Platt's really good at throwing an image out there, putting it in someone's mouth, but it lets you paint the rest of the picture. There's a scene when the Count is in the jail and the three-legged Cyberman is attacking him, and they rush in, and it gets out the window. And just with a few lines, he really evokes a really strong images where he talks about, the doctor says, you know, Mary, grab that lantern and see if you can see where the Cyberman's going. And she says, he's scrabbling up the wall. And it's a few lines, but because of the atmosphere, this previous sound design and the whole thing, you can see the lantern. You can see it scrabbling up the wall. You can see Mary Shelley leaning out the window to see it as they're unlocking this prison cage to see if the Count's dead or not, and it's just really, he's really good at that.
Oh yeah, I was earlier in our first episode complaining about, like, I kind of wish Doctor Who would have you know, hoping for smaller scale kind of Doctor Who stories. And here I am going for a really ridiculously big scale Doctor Who one over a very well done small scale one, which is, you know, I am a huge hypocrite.
You have the right to be inconsistent in this podcast.
It's just like Doctor Who is.
but yeah, there's a lot of things about the Silver Turk that are really admirable, and people should listen to it.
It had been a while since I'd heard a Big Finish audio drama, and so first I was struck by how professional it is. I mean, I knew that from previous ones, but they can do the sound design. They have, mm-hmm. It seems in some odd way, much smoother than the TV show at this point, which always seems to sort of crash from moment to moment for me, and never. Like, I always think it's going to go off the rails at any moment.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, I think with Big Finish, often it's like they're more compartmentalized. And it seems like if it's going to be a good, strong episode, like a story from Big Finish, it is. It's either kind of a really bad one and you kind of write the whole thing off, or it's really good.
Yeah.
The TV series seems to swing, has a lot of pendulum sway within each episode, which I think The Nightmare in Silver really does. There's a lot of strong stuff. I mean, Matt Smith's performance is really good, and him wrestling with himself.
Yeah, that was...
His performance, it kind of has that really forced, like, this is a showcase for Matt Smith, but he's fantastic.
Well, I admit, I was really scared to see, like, holy crap, the Cybermen actually got into the Doctor's brain.
And there are a couple really clever things, like the gold gag is masterfully done because he masks, like, as a geek, as soon as the Doctor says the golden ticket, you should know it's going to come into play.
And I didn't think that.
But because it's a joke on Willy Wonka, you think that's the end of it. You go, right. Oh, golden ticket, it's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and you forget about it, mm-hmm. which I think is hugely clever. And then it's so satisfying when he brings it back. And I should have seen that.
You know, it is interesting to contrast, the Silver Turk has Cybermen very early in their development. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like 10th Planet.
They still have names.
10th Planet era Cybermen. And Nightmare in Silver is like the end result of the Cybermen when they're like super powerful, and there actually is a protocol of like Cybermen show up, you blow the planet up.
I got to give the Silver Turk marks on cleverness as far as Cybermen go, because I loved the idea, which I don't think I've seen in Doctor Who before, that they can infect living people with the cyber virus that forces them to create more Cybermen.
Yeah.
Because the Dr. Drossel, I think, and also our main guy, both get infected by looking in the Cyberman's eyes. Mm-hmm. The Doctor does too, but he can resist it.
Yep.
And that makes them both sympathetic to the Cybermen and also grants them the ability to create wooden marionettes with cyber technology within them. This is very Borg-like. But just by looking at the Cybermen, you can now they can reproduce themselves in the mind of someone else.
And it gives all sorts of outlets because of the era the story is set in for the great sound design of the wooden sound of the marionettes that come after them, and the wooden clop of the
marionette horse. The clickety sounds are really good.
To be my literary nerd for a moment, that's clearly an E.T.A. Hoffman reference. He's a little bit earlier than the 1870 whatever period that the thing is set in, but his first published story, I just learned this today, was about the Turk. But of course his main reputation is living marionettes and other sort of unusual, uncanny, supernatural things. So I think that's what it's going for there.
I mean, and we've seen that in a lot of other science fiction now. That's become a trope. But for audio, it has a lot of great sound to lend atmosphere. And I think Silver Turk, also Mark Platt, I don't know why he hasn't been asked to script something for the new series. I think he's a very clever writer, great dialogue. He has a lot of funny bits. The one phrase I remember is temporally unethical, that the Doctor says, which I love, and when he heals somebody.
Yeah, the missing eye from the count.
Yeah, and
Oh, yeah, the eye stuff was
There's a lot of fun dialogue between him and Mary Shelley when they're waiting in the cafe, and they think it's still 1819.
Yep, and they marry a lot of the TV movie doctor when he's excited, and he wants to go waltz, and he's super excited, which really feels like the TV movie. But then he also has a lot darker, somber tone that is more in line with the Big Finish stuff and stuff that we saw in Night of the Doctor, too, in the new series, where he's kind of cold about people who've died and makes jokes.
Yeah, I think we'll have a lot to say in future episodes about the Eighth Doctor and whether he's a televisual creation or a literary creation or an audio creation.
Yes. He's really, this the Eighth Doctor stuff is not very well explored in fandom that I've seen. And I don't quite know why that is.
In some ways, it's explored in contradictory dimensions.
Yes, it's the most varied portrayals, because often it's not even a portrayal by Paul McGann.
That's right.
But here's the thing. This is the stuff. The reason, I mean, these are all things that I loved about The Silver Turk, but some of the hang-ups I have about Nightmare in Silver, and I think it's been widely stated, but it's such a weird quality when Clara leads that army. She feels like she's being a play soldier, but the children that she's in charge of are in deadly jeopardy, and she seems to kind of be play acting, and the quality is really weird.
Yeah, I don't care for Nightmare in Silver much at all.
And yeah, that's the one that really jumps out at me for like having a hard time believing it.
I much prefer The Doctor's Wife to Nightmare in Silver.
It's much more Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
Yeah, by far.
This feels more like he got a laundry list of things that he had to force into.
Yeah, I know he... The episode. I know Moffat contacted him and said, I want you to do a Cybermen story, and I want you to make the Cybermen really scary.
They were, but they're all scary things you've seen before. Either they move in Matrix time, which we've seen tons of, or their limbs fall off, which was really scary when Moffat did it, and like the Big Bang and whatever, it's in that, or the Pandora opens or something in the end of the fifth season where it was just the Cyberman head or the limbs. Yeah. It's still scary, but we've already seen a lot of those surprises with them. And I mean, I think again, it's just that sort of weird feeling of where it's dramatic and where it's comic was really unclear, because Clara seemed really weirdly written in there. Like, she didn't take any of it seriously, yet she kind of did, and
it all seemed by the numbers for me.
Yeah.
It didn't. In some ways, The Doctor's Wife seemed like, oh, I've seen Neil Gaiman do this 100 times over the last 20 years, but I liked it much better.
In the context of Doctor Who, you'd never seen it.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was unusual there. Nightmare in Silver, except for some signature Neil Gaiman things like the Edwardian junk shop aesthetic at the beginning,
the universe's largest abandoned amusement park.
Yeah, that kind of like has a Neil Gaiman attitude about it. But everything else,
it had a weird structure to it too. It was really weird in the opening sequence that the military showed up, pointed guns, and then went okay, and then walked out. And it was just sort of had this quality of like, there are army people somewhere here. Now let's keep moving with the rest.
Psychic paper really did its job.
And then it's like, we'll get to them later. It had this really weird structure to it. I mean, the other thing is, I was watching it and I went, it's okay. Yeah, I don't like this. And as I was watching it, though, I was going, why do I remember just really not liking this? I don't think it's that spectacular, but I remember really not liking it. And then I got to that last line, which I think is that's the one. Oh, it retroactively made me hate the entire thing.
Oh, what does it remind me?
When the 11th Doctor is saying, talking about Clara, and she's like a mystery wrapped in an enigma in a skirt that's just a little too tight, and then he makes that leering smile. It was like, it's the most overt and I think off-character sexual Doctor Who moment I've seen on the TV show.
That's a Stephen Moffat line. That's not a Neil Gaiman line.
No,
I would stake my reputation on it.
Plus, it's so bizarre because she's not wearing a tight skirt.
Yeah.
And we've also had however many seasons of Amy Pond, who genuinely wore tight skirts.
So it's a conversation for a later episode, but I noticed that in Nightmare in Silver too, where she was trying to determine whether it was him or the cyber controller talking to her, and he said something casually dismissive about her appearance.
Yes, which sort of felt like Peter Capaldi there.
Yes, exactly. Anticipated that. Peter Capaldi, but has a completely different feel because Matt Smith is saying it as opposed to Peter Capaldi. And this is something that my wife talks about a lot in relation to how you can criticize an attractive woman on TV or in a way that you could. But that's, we'll put a pin in that. We'll talk about that in a later episode.
Another maybe special topics, Dalek.
I'll admit I watched it again for, you know, the podcast here, and I was kind of surprised. I did like it a lot more the second time I saw it.
Yeah, see, that's always weird. It just depends.
I remember seeing the first time I saw Nightmare in Silver, I was like, God, Neil kind of phoned that one in. But the second time I saw it, I liked it a lot more. And I feel kind of odd picking it over the Silver Turk. Because the Silver Turk was really cool, but I still like it.
It's fine. Your body's fancy, and so is mine.
All right, so final verdict is, Calvin, you are?
I'm still with Nightmare and
Silver. Nightmare and Silver, Josh.
Silver Turk.
Gotta be Silver Turk for me. That's our show. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed it, please tell your friends and write reviews on our iTunes page. Join us next time when we'll be discussing Kelvin's first Doctor Who story, The Silurians.
Yep.
And we'll be pitting the 11th Doctor story, A Town Called Mercy, against the first Doctor story, The Gunfighters.
Woohoo!
Until then, this is Pat.
I'm Kelvin.
And I'm Josh saying,
get off my world!
That was better.